Name something that gets passed around.
A joint.
A joint.
Legalized marijuana is always a very difficult question.
The time is long overdue for us to remove the federal prohibition on marijuana.
From now on, I smoke weed exclusively with white people.
Well, I'm getting higher next time.
They're walking on their pants with their cap on backwards, listening to the Enema Man, the Snoopy Snoopy Poop Dog.
There's definitely cannabis in there, and it makes sure that I can sleep now.
What's to keep somebody from getting all potted up on weed and then getting behind the wheel?
Don't piss off your old dealer.
Marijuana is not the kind of thing that ought to be legalized.
I know you're not supposed to admit that you smoke pot, but I don't drink alcohol.
Let's get out of here. I have some really good weed back at the hotel.
I used to smoke marijuana.
I don't care if an adult wants to smoke marijuana. They shouldn't go to prison for it either.
Ah, sure, you hypocrite. Hey, welcome back, everyone. Time for Toker Talk Radio. Glad to have you here. I'm Radical Russ. All sorts of big things happening. I can't quite tell you everything that's happening yet, but I will tell you that May 1st is going to be a big day for this show. So, that's all I'll give you right now. May 1st. Look forward to it. As we get into this hour, we're going to talk about a few different stories in depth. California senior facing hostile crowds trying to educate other seniors about medical marijuana. That's kind of interesting. Little battles going on in the senior citizen set in California. We'll discuss that more. David Downs has a great story on that. Also, the New York Times, in our second segment after the 20 after break, the New York Times has done a fabulous expose on the use of no-knock raids to serve drug warrants. Data they've put together have shown 81 people and 13 officers killed in the past decade or so in these kind of raids. Questioning, why do we do it? What's the point? And then in our third segment, oh my goodness, I got to speak this afternoon, this morning actually, with Noelle Crombie. She's the beat reporter on marijuana for the Oregonian here in Portland. And she's doing a story on the closing of the Third Eye on Hawthorne. And this is a big deal here in Portland. The Third Eye was Jack Herer's head shop on Hawthorne Boulevard, which is kind of a hippie district in Portland. And now run by his son, Dan. And I guess it's closing down. And from the tone of, or the tenor of her questions, it seems to be, you know, the question was like, in the world of legalization, what's the relevance of the head shop anymore? And so I got a few quotes in with Noelle. Those should be appearing in the Oregonian soon. But in our third segment, the Oregonian also, Noelle wrote this story on how the state police are saying that Oregon falls short of complying with the Cole memo. I've been warning folks that Jeff Sessions thinks the Cole memo is just a checklist of, oh, here's the excuses I need to be able to bust pot. This Oregonian story lends more credence to that thought of mine. So we'll get to that coming up a little later. But right now, oh my God, some of the, we are going to be expanding the show. I'll give you a little hint. The show will be expanding a little bit to cover other criminal justice problems, especially in this second hour. And I gotta say, the cruelty, the barbarity, the viciousness, the evil of some of our law enforcement officers must be put to an end. And I'm afraid that if justice doesn't take care of it, if we don't get some justice, we don't get some consequences in some of these cases, there's going to be an unfortunate set of episodes, some Second Amendment sort of remedies that are going to happen because the people aren't going to take much more of this. It's the case of Darren Rainey. Darren Rainey, need we say a black man, was in the Miami-Dade County Department of Corrections holding. He was at the Dade Correctional Institution. And he was doing 2 years on cocaine possession charges. Oh, no, on a cocaine possession charge. I'm sorry, one charge. Cocaine possession charge. Possession, folks. Just had some coke. 2 years he's got to do in prison. Okay, so he's 2 years in prison. He was locked in his in a shower by guards because he shit in his cell and smeared shit all over the walls. So the guards said, you know, you got to clean yourself up. We got to get you clean. Get in the shower. So he agrees to get in the shower. Now, the shower's mechanism is controlled by the guards outside. Okay? So, Rainey starts cleaning himself in the shower and then stops because he's like, hey, the water's too hot. Now, according to the Miami Herald, they had reported previously that the shower was frequently used to punish prisoners by being turned up or down. The state limit on the heat of water in the showers is 120 degrees. Now, right there, that's pretty hot, right? I'm a guy who likes a really hot, hot tub. Like, most people don't like it as hot as I do in a hot tub. And I can get it up to about 106, 108. Then I'm like, damn, that's pretty hot. Rainey was locked in the shower and blasted with water between 160 and 180 degrees. For 2 hours, folks, 2 hours, this man was locked in a shower, sprayed with 160 to 180 degree water. Now, there was four guards: John Fanfan, Cornelius Thompson, Ronald Clark, and Edwina Williams, a woman guard involved, ignored his screams that he couldn't take it anymore, laughed when he kicked the door. After 2 hours of this, when the guards finally opened the shower, he wasn't breathing. He was on the floor in 3 inches of water. His skin had turned red and was flaking off. When he was removed, some of his skin allegedly peeled off his body. Guy was a brisket. Dead. Killed. June 23rd, 2012. Died in a prison shower. The punishment for smearing shit on your cell is death in Miami-Dade. So this story came up in 2012, right? So why am I talking about it now? On Friday, Miami-Dade State Attorney Catherine Fernandez Rundle announced there would be no criminal charges leveled against the guards. No criminal charges. State law says the heat on a shower could only be 120 degrees. These guys are putting them in for 2 hours, 160 to 180. This was done as a regular pattern, regular practice by the guards to punish prisoners with super hot water. No charges. Now, that decision, this is according to a story at Jezebel.com that writes, the decision was based on the officer's testimony and inconclusive evidence that Rainey's death was caused by the shower and not some undiagnosed heart condition. Family members say they were pressured to cremate his body quickly, so any potential forensic analysis is gone. Yeah. We can't punish these guys with criminal charges for putting the inmate in the shower and scalding him with 160, 180 degree water because that might not have killed him. It might have been a heart attack from a heart condition, right? Well, if the guy had a heart condition, don't you think putting him in the boiling hot shower is what's going to cause the heart attack? Oh, for God's sake, this is unbelievable. This is reprehensible. Heinous. This I don't have enough thesaurus to describe this. There's no way to punish or charge someone for torturing people anymore? Does Florida not have a torture charge? I imagine it's a stand your ground state. They probably torture. Expecting to have a torture statute? There is a pattern of this. The Miami Herald wrote about a man named Harold Hempstead, who was an orderly in the mental ward when Rainey died. He was the first to raise concerns over Rainey's death. Miami Herald writes, quote, Hempstead and other inmates and mental health staff told the Herald that state prison guards used forms of torture, including dousing prisoners with buckets of chemicals, over-medicating them, forcing them to fight each other, and starving them. A group of officers at the prison that served inmates empty food trays, known as air trays, was known as the Diet Squad, and they often preyed on inmates who were too ill to coherently report what had happened, prisoners said. Around the time of Rainey's death, another inmate hanged himself from an air conditioning vent, leaving a note sewn into his shorts detailing a litany of alleged abuses against inmates in the mental health unit. Quote, I'm in a mental health facility. I'm supposed to be getting help for my depression, suicidal tendencies, and I was sexually assaulted, end quote, wrote Richard Mayer, age 40. So, yeah, there you go, folks. That is what we have in our American criminal justice system. Boiling men to death for smearing shit on a wall. Boiling a guy to death who was only there because he was taking a drug for himself. It's bigger than just marijuana, folks. It's bigger than just drugs. It's a wholesale pattern and a paradigm in our society that disregards human life. Don't tell me we're a society that values human life. I've done this too long.
This is the Russ Belville Show on CannabisRadio.com.
In the interest of fair and balanced journalism, the Russ Belville Show presents the anti-drug public service announcement of the day.
When I was growing up, my parents and I would go to the schoolyard and play ball every weekend. They'd teach me how if I practiced and didn't give up, my swing would get better. But if I got in front of the ball and wasn't afraid, I could stop it. That there weren't any shortcuts to becoming a better player. But if I believed in myself, I could do it. Funny. All that time, I thought they were teaching me how to play baseball.
This has been the Russ Belville Show's anti-drug public service announcement of the day. Exclusively on RadicalRust.com.
The Russ Belville Show is proudly sponsored by the Marijuana Business Association. The MJBA, called by NBC News the Cannabis Chamber of Commerce, is the fastest growing business association in the fastest growing industry in America. I've been working with the MJBA for years, and I personally invite you to join the MJBA. MJBA also publishes the popular MJ Headline News on Facebook and the MJNewsNetwork.com and Marijuana Channel 1 on YouTube. Visit MJBA.net for more details.
You're not high. You're listening to the Russ Belville Show.
Shena, jag heter David, PKA Dirtball. Vi ska röka hela tiden, alla år.
Okay, maybe you're high too. Warning, hits taken on this show are larger than they appear. Do not try this at home. These people are professionals. Or at least they pay me to say that.
Yeah, baby! Yeah.
A public service message from the Russ Belville Show. Pod 2.0. It's not your father's Woodstock weed. This is the Russ Belville Show on CannabisRadio.com.
All right, welcome back, everybody. 13 after the hour, and we're taking a look at a story in the San Francisco Chronicle by our friend David Downs. It's entitled, For Many Seniors, Medical Cannabis is More Threat Than Remedy. The story details one of the most difficult fights we've got in trying to spread the word about medical cannabis. And that is people's fear of it, people's misinformation, the stereotypes they still believe. I mean, when you look at the stats, what age group of people are the least likely to approve of marijuana? Did you guess? Senior citizens. That's right. Senior citizens least likely to support marijuana. Now, if you look at racial groups, ethnicities, which group is least likely to support marijuana reforms? These African Americans? No, I'm sorry, not African Americans. Is it Latinos? No, I'm sorry, two strikes. One more strike and the Jones family can steal. Is it Asians? Yes, that's right. Asians least likely to support marijuana. So what happens when you are trying to convince Asian senior citizens to use cannabis? Well, that's this story in the San Francisco Chronicle. And it begins by discussing the case of Dr. Floyd Huen. And my Chinese pronunciation, H-U-E-N. I don't know. Huen? Dr. Floyd Huen. And the story begins, before it even begins, the monthly meeting of the people of Parkside Sunset had devolved into an angry crowd of seniors chanting Cantonese. No invaders, no invaders, no invaders, yelled out 100 or so Sunset District residents crammed into a humid room inside the Taraval police station earlier this month. Their target, Floyd Huen, a Bay Area geriatrician who once led Oakland's Highland Hospital. Huen, age 70, has made it his late-in-life mission to spread awareness of the benefits of medical marijuana among the group he has found most hostile to it, elderly Asian Americans. Now, Huen is the husband of the former mayor of Oakland, Gene Kwan, and he's trying to persuade this group of senior citizens on a licensed pot shop. He and his wife are going to own this licensed pot shop in this Asian senior citizen neighborhood, and they're saying, no invaders, no invaders. When he began trying to speak, they shouted at him, liar, child endangerer. When he was escorted out, the crowd cheered. Now, this is something that's just amazing to me. Because what is the stereotype you think of when you think of herbal remedies? Right? When it comes to, think of a doctor prescribing an herbal remedy to someone, you think of Chinese herbal medicine, don't you? You think of ginseng and this the root and this bark and this whatever that the Chinese herbalist, the ancient medicine, to think that they would be most opposed to this, that senior Chinese people would be opposed to medical cannabis. It's just amazing how deep propaganda, scaremongering, demonization can bring people, can tear them away from their own heritage, from their own background. I often talk about how we Americans, we have this hemp heritage, that our country was founded by hemp farmers. Chinese heritage, America, we're talking 400 years of heritage at best. China, 4,000 years of heritage. Prohibition of marijuana and the propaganda around it has enabled people of Chinese descent to disregard 4,000 years. Emperor Shenang, 2700 BC, the first recorded instances of the use of medical cannabis. Medical cannabis is a Chinese thing. How can this be? It's a tough road to hoe, folks. According to statistics, the California Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, just 2.2% of Californians over age 65 had ever used medical cannabis. Huen and other doctors agree that that's exactly who needs medical cannabis. This is the thing. It's like, I often make a joke on the road that when you turn 50 and get your AARP card, that ought to be your medical marijuana card in all 50 states. You make it to 50, you did a whole half century. Here, smoke some weed. We'll leave you alone. You made it to 50, you know. You got it. This is where your life, this is good. You're good, right? But really, it's as a joke, though, there's a kernel of truth in there. You get to be my age. I'm 49. I'm 1 year away from that card. You get to be my age, your back starts to hurt. You have trouble sleeping. You get a little indigestion. You start getting arthritis, stiffness. This is the herbal medicine that's best for that. And to read this story, it's a great story. It's at the San Francisco Chronicle, sfchronicle.com. Just look for many seniors, medical cannabis is more threat than remedy, by David Downs. Interesting story here on this. 2.2% of the seniors likely are the only ones that have tried pot in California. Meanwhile, there's about 15% of the population in California is seniors. There's like 40 million people in California. 15% of them are seniors. By 2020 or 2030, excuse me, they're positioning that at 20%. That one out of five Californians will be a senior citizen. Now, one of the problems... Oh, pardon me.
Oh, God, I thought that was absolutely dreadful.
Anyway, what was I saying? Oh, yeah, seniors. Check out Should Grandma Smoke Pot? Get that on TV in your area. Bobby Platshorn and thesilvertour.org. They can find ways to get it on your local TV station. Just hit up thesilvertour.org because we get Grandma on our side. We've won. We're back with a look at the New York Times and no-knock drug raids when we return.
At Herbie's Cannabis Seeds, we pride ourselves on bringing you the best quality seeds from the world's most respected cannabis seed producers, all at the lowest online prices. You can find Herbie's Seeds at herbiesheadshop.com. All cannabis seeds are sold as souvenirs, and as a means of preserving cannabis genetics, Herbie's Seeds in no way intends to condone, promote, or incite the use of illegal or controlled substances. We strongly urge all prospective customers to check their national laws prior to placing an order. Herbie's Seeds at herbiesheadshop.com. Proud sponsors of the Russ Belville Show and 420 Radio.
You're not high. You're listening to the Russ Belville Show.
I was asked by a group of children what to do if they were offered drugs. And I answered, just say no.
Okay, maybe you're high too. Warning, hits taken on this show are larger than they appear. Do not try this at home. These people are professionals. Or at least they pay me to say that.
Dude.
A public service message from the Russ Belville Show. Warning, hits taken on this show are larger than they appear. Do not try this at home. These people are professionals. Or at least they pay me to say that. This is Dan Michaels from danmichaelsaudio.com, and you're listening to Radical Russ on cannabisradio.com.
Welcome back, everyone. I hope you had a good 420 break, and we return with another gruesome story. Full of gruesome stories today. This one comes by way of the New York Times, which on Saturday, on its online edition, posted a piece entitled Door-Busting Drug Raids Leave a Trail of Blood. Using SWAT officers to storm into homes to execute search warrants has led time and again to avoidable deaths, gruesome injuries, and costly legal settlements. And to me, one of the most impactful parts of this piece is the multimedia way in which it is presented. You go to the website and it looks like this. Video of a police raid. Helmet mounted camera busting the door in.
Put your face down.
Struggling with another man. You got to love how they tell them to relax when they've got them, six of them holding them down, at knees in their back, wrenching their arms behind their backs. Relax! Just relax! That's the beginning of that story, the New York Times story on door-busting drug raids leave a trail of blood. They discuss many of the stories. As you scroll through, you get picture after picture. You get to see the results of some of these drug raids. You get to see how this really affects people. For example, you get the picture of the crib where a flashbang grenade was thrown in. The heat singed away much of the pillow and dissolved the mesh side of the playpen. The young boy who was in that playpen suffered a severe burn on his chest, put a hole in his chest. And if I'm recalling the correct circumstance, in this case, the officers were found to have had no wrongdoing. They were following police procedure. That's what the war on drugs is doing, folks, is leading to these kind of raids, and these happen thousands of times a year. According to the Times, the New York Times investigation into this, this is off of open records requests, they found at least 81 civilians and 13 law enforcement officers died in such raids from 2010 to 2016. A six-year period, 81 civilian deaths, 13 police deaths, scores of others were maimed or wounded. Innocents have died in attacks on wrong addresses, including a 7-year-old girl in Detroit, and collaterally as the police pursued other residents, among them a 68-year-old grandfather in Framingham, Massachusetts. Stray bullets have whizzed through neighboring homes, and in dozens of instances, the victims of police gunfire have included the family dog. We've told you many of those in the past as well. This is video from another no-knock raid. Three shots, man killed right there in his own home. This is what's happening every day in America in the name of the war on drugs. And the idea that supposedly justifies these raids is that we want to surprise the suspects. We want to make sure these violent drug dealers don't have a chance to get their guns and be armed, lead to a standoff. We want to make sure they don't flush the drugs, they don't destroy the evidence. But law enforcement professionals, analysts who study this, have recognized long ago that this should be reserved for the most extreme of circumstances. SWAT was created in 1983, Chief Daryl Gates in Los Angeles. It all had to do with dealing with, you know, major terrorist types organizations and armed hostage standoffs, bank robberies and the such, where they're holding hostages, not for people who may or may not be involved in a drug trade, but are just in a residential neighborhood. Of course, a lot of these raids happen in low-income neighborhoods. And a lot of times these raids will...
Front door's open. I'll get it. I got it, Jeff. I'm going to go to the left side. Police department, search warrant! Police department, search warrant! With you. Need one.
With you. Okay, just relax. Okay. One on the couch. There.
Up, hon. Get up.
It's a little
on
girl.
On top of your head. Put your hands on top of your head.
You got a female right here.
She eight, I got it. 9 years old.
You're gonna have to step back over here with me.
Automatic weapon pointed at her.
There you go.
Okay. Every day, multiple times a day in this country, raids just like that are going down. Over the name, over the drug war, over a tip from an anonymous informant, and they're doing far more harm than good.
Fire department, what's the location of the emergency?
I don't know.
Who shot him? Ma'am, is he watching there at your home?
That was the shooting at the home of Jose Guerena. He was awakened by his wife when she saw shadowy figures in the yard. He grabbed his rifle. He was a military veteran. He'd served our country. Shadowy figures are approaching our house. My wife and I are in danger. I live in a country with a Second Amendment, so I grabbed my rifle to defend my home. They break the door open, fire 71 times in 7 seconds. You heard the pops. 71 times in 7 seconds, hitting him more than 20 times. Which, by the way, the guy was in a hall. He was in a hallway when he was shot. They shot 71 times, only hit him 20 times. That should scare the hell out of you right away from where the rest of those bullets going. And evidence showed Jose Guarena never fired his rifle, and no drugs were found. No drugs were found, but the man lost his life. These raids happen every day in America. Every single day. To people like you, people like me, a no-knock raid, the tip of an informant, for what? There's so much that has been changed here in our laws. There's a great timeline that the Times puts on this story as well, leading through the 1600s in English common law, all the way through the most recent cases. In 1791, Fourth Amendment bans unreasonable search and seizure. 1914, Supreme Court says evidence from illegal searches must be excluded from trials. In 1914, this was the fruit of the poisonous tree, where if you used illegal methods to be able to get that evidence could not be used in court. And the idea being to prevent the agents of law enforcement of the state, the agents of the state, from committing crimes to get evidence to prosecute you with. 1914, this has been around. Keep that in mind for a second. 1914, that was Weeks versus the United States. Now, in 1958, Miller versus the United States held that prior notice is required before police can force entry. They have to knock, police, and then they can burst in. So it wasn't until 1958 they even had to tell you they were cops bursting into your house. 1995, police need not knock if there isn't risk of danger or destruction of evidence. So from 58 through 95, police had to knock and say they were there, but then the courts decided, well, if they knock, they might tip these guys off, they'll flush their drugs, so you don't have to knock. 1997, only reasonable suspicion of danger or evidence destruction is needed to force entry. Richards v. Wisconsin. Only reasonable suspicion. I got a hunch. I got a pretty reasonable hunch there's danger going on or destruction of evidence, so we can bust down the door. 2003 case, U.S. v. Banks. Police can force entry 15 seconds after knocking. You got 15 seconds, folks. Keep that cocaine by the toilet, I guess. And then 2006, the disgusting case of 2006. No suppression of evidence obtained from illegal searches in the Hudson v. Michigan case. Something that had been in our law since 1914. You get something illegally, you can't use it. Well, not anymore, not since 2006. No suppression of evidence obtained from illegal searches. This also has a great map of the states based on where no-knock warrants are routinely granted. Almost all of them. I would like to point out, though, that in the West, other than California, Washington, Idaho, and Nevada does not grant no-knock warrants except under exigent circumstances. So I have to go to a judge and get a no-knock warrant under exigent circumstances, rather than the other states like California, where they just routinely grant them. It's a rubber stamp, basically. We can show you that map here on the screen for those of you watching on YouTube. Only Oregon, my home state of Oregon, is the only state in the United States where police must always announce themselves. Good for us here in Oregon. That's the way it should be everywhere. Police must announce themselves in Oregon. In 2015, the Utah legislature banned forcible entry if the only suspected offense is drug possession. And Florida has a state Supreme Court disallowed no-knock warrants. So there's no-knock warrants. There aren't allowed in Florida through the state Supreme Court because of the opinion that there was a staggering potential for violence to both occupants and police. Well, yeah, duh. Something we've got to change in this country. We've got to end the routine use of no-knock warrants. And it's not to say all no-knock warrants. Like, there's some cases where I can see that might be useful. That might be necessary and reasonable. But to routinely be giving these no-knock warrants out in these drug cases, to routinely be injuring and harming people, and not just the victims of these raids, but the law enforcement officers themselves. We wonder why these cops are so trigger happy when we keep sending them to bust into people's homes. People who could justifiably want to fire back at them, not knowing that they're cops. Wait till the guy goes out to the convenience store. Catch him on the roadside or something.
This is the Russ Belville Show on CannabisRadio.com.
Hey everybody, it's Radical Russ here from 420 Radio, inviting you to be like me and get your ink done at Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo, Fort Worth's most female-friendly, clean, sterile, awesome tattoo shop. Thomas and his crew are true artists who can design you a custom piece or use a design you bring in. Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo also offers all styles of tattooing as well as piercings and all-around fun. In the DFW area, stop by Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo and tell them Radical Russ sent you. Trust me, it'll feel awesome.
You're not high. You're listening to the Russ Belville Show.
People addicted to marijuana are 3 times more likely to be addicted to heroin.
Okay, well, maybe you're high, too. Warning. Hits taken on this show are larger than they appear. Do not try this at home. These people are professionals. Or at least they pay me to say that.
Oh, I could have smoked that pot.
A public service message from the Russ Belville Show.
Most of us pirates, we go on vacation to North Dakota, you know, because they've got a town called Argusville. What are you smoking there, boy?
This is Dan Michaels from danmichaelsaudio.com, and you're listening to Radical Russ on CannabisRadio.com.
Welcome back, everybody. 37 after the hour, and we've been reporting on Attorney General Jeff Sessions and his opinions about marijuana. Not the best of opinions, but recently he said a few things about the Cole memo. The memo that the previous administration had put forth, their Department of Justice, on the priorities of the federal government when it comes to the enforcement of the federal marijuana laws. And many people have been trying to divine exactly what he's saying and what it might mean or what's going to happen. I fall into that paranoid, pessimistic category of this guy hates weed, and you can bet he's going to try to fight it every way he can. But recently, he has had some good things to say about the Cole memo, in this clip from last week on Wednesday when he was speaking in front of a crowd, and he had said that the Cole memo had some good things about it.
The Cole memorandum set up some policies under President Obama's Department of Justice about how cases should be selected in those states and what would be appropriate for federal prosecution, much of which I think is valid. I may have some different ideas myself in addition to that.
So he had pointed that out, that the Cole memo was, much of it was valid as far as how the federal government should be spending its resources. He also appeared on the Laura Ingraham show where he said that they were developing a plan.
What about the existing states, like Colorado?
Yes, well, that's what I mean. Those states, we're going to, it still remains against federal law to possess and distribute marijuana.
Got it.
And we're going to develop a fair plan for that.
a fair plan for that. Well, let's talk about this because the Oregon State Police have just released a new report entitled A Baseline Evaluation of Cannabis Enforcement Priorities in Oregon. Let me just read to you from the executive summary from the Oregon State Police. Oregon has had a state-authorized medical cannabis system since 1998, and in November 2014, Oregon voters approved the Control, Regulation, and Taxation of Marijuana and Industrial Hemp Act, commonly known as Measure 91, to legally commercialize non-medical retail cannabis in the state. The Drug Enforcement Section at the Oregon State Police created this report to survey currently available data in an effort to evaluate state compliance with the federal guidance for enforcement priorities issued by former Federal Department of Justice Deputy Attorney General James M. Cole. And then they list the 8 federal priorities. 1, preventing the distribution of marijuana to minors. 2, preventing revenue from the sale of marijuana from going to criminal enterprises, gangs, and cartels. 3, preventing the diversion of marijuana from states where it is legal under state law to other states. You made a weird typo there. Oh, I see. Legal under state law in some form to other states. They put from there. Messed me up. Typo. Preventing the diversion of marijuana from states where it is legal under state law in some form to other states. 4, preventing state-authorized marijuana activity from being used as a cover or pretext for the trafficking of other illegal drugs or illegal activity. 5, preventing violence and the use of firearms in the cultivation and distribution of marijuana. 6, preventing drug driving and the exacerbation of other adverse public health consequences associated with marijuana use. 7, preventing the growing of marijuana on public lands and the attendant public safety and environmental dangers posed by marijuana production on public lands. And 8, preventing marijuana possession or use on federal property. To this end, this report examines Oregon's compliance on mitigating these threats and analyzes areas of concern specifically related to these enforcement priorities. Okay, so we got the 8 tenets of the Cole memo. And here's what the Oregon State Police is telling the federal government about how well we're complying with the Cole memo. Cannabis diversion. That was one of the points, right? In the cannabis diversion section, they say diverted Oregon cannabis has an expansive geographic footprint and has been detected outside of the United States. 6 Oregon counties are tied to the majority of diversion activity in the state, accounting for 76% of diversion seizures by weight and 81% of diversion incidents. Oregon-originated cannabis is trafficked to known distribution hubs across the southeastern, midwestern, and northeastern United States, specifically the states of Illinois, Minnesota, New York, and Florida. There is a geographic relationship between the state-authorized Oregon Medical Marijuana Program registrants and dominant diversion counties, originating counties of diversion activity. Right there, folks. There's what Jeff Sessions needs to hear. Not only is recreational marijuana leading to diversion, not just out of state, but out of the country, but that there's a relationship between how much medical marijuana cards there are and the places that are diverting the marijuana out of state. In the section marked accompanying public health and safety, they say that the rate of Oregon's traffic fatalities has not changed significantly since legalization. The cost and rate of cannabis extraction burn victims has increased substantially since legalization. 63% of Oregon drivers don't know it's legal not to drive. It's not legal to drive after using cannabis. But generally, no major change in traffic fatalities or youth use rates. Cultivation on public lands, they say, has not affected that. Legalization hasn't affected that one. Violence and illicit activities. They say criminals are exploiting Oregon's cannabis industry for financial crimes and fraud. Legal entities in Oregon's cannabis industry have been targeted by violent criminals and armed robberies. So, that is as their statement here on the state's compliance with cannabis priorities in the Cole memo. And the write-up here, Noel Crombie's got it written up in the Oregonian. You can find it at OregonLive.com. The analysts identified Portland, Eugene, Medford, and Grants Pass as cities with the greatest level of connection to black market destinations, which include Illinois, Minnesota, New York, Connecticut, Florida, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Idaho. The report states, quote, "The illicit exportation of cannabis must be stemmed as it undermines the spirit of the law and the integrity of the legal market. It steals economic power from the market, the government, and the citizens of Oregon, and furnishes it to criminals, thereby tarnishing state compliance efforts," end quote. According to state police, Oregon falls short of complying with the memo. In addition to creating a legal market for cannabis production, legalization has, quote, "provided an effective means to launder cannabis products and proceeds where, in essence, actors can exploit legal mechanisms to obscure products' origin and conceal true profits, thereby blurring the boundaries of the legal market and complicating enforcement efforts," end quote. They say the surplus amount of production in Oregon is between $4.7 and $9.4 billion. The state is now, of course, looking to curb the amount of cannabis being grown by people. The Oregonian, Noel, writes, quote, "Oregon lawmakers have grappled with how to address the nearly 20-year-old medical marijuana program with a long history of loose regulation that has made it ripe for exploitation." They say the most immediate cannabis threat facing Oregon is the proliferation of butane hash oil manufacturing. That's what they consider the most severe threat. At least 30 people were sent to the Oregon Burn Center between 2015 and 2016. 1 year, 30 people burned in hash oil explosions. State police, citing data from the Burn Center, report that Medicare and Medicaid covered the bulk of the medical costs. Combined, the government programs paid about $7.6 million for medical care for hash oil burn victims between 2013 and 2016. Of course, a lot of that demand for the hash oil is not just the profit you can make here in Oregon off it, but wow, you send it back to New York. I've heard of people in New York spending $100 a gram on cannabis oil. So this is the big smoking gun that Jeff Sessions is going to need to start clamping down on marijuana. And I keep telling people, you're underestimating how creative these bastards are going to get when it comes to this. I think that I can think of some ways. Like Jeff Sessions could point to this report and say, see, legalization's not keeping marijuana from leaving the state. It's allowing criminals to launder their drug proceeds. You're violating 2, 3, 4 tenets of the Cole memo. So from here on out, any state that allows people to grow cannabis that does not have a law punishing people for growing cannabis loses their federal highway funds or their Medicare reimbursement grants or whatever else. There's all sorts of federal purse strings that could be pulled here. There's all sorts of little extortive mechanisms they could use to go against these states and to make them have this political battle over ratcheting down the ability of people to grow their own cannabis. I can see this happening. I can imagine it happening. I can see the federal government taking a perspective that, all right, in the states that have legalized, we can't really stop people from possessing it. We can't force them to bust people who possess it. But we could stop them from home growing through these extortion threats and force them to have to at least buy in a commercial pot shop. And at least the commercial pot shop's grows will be controlled and seed to sale tracked and all of that. That's one way it could go. One way it could go is to say, all right, in the commercial states, no more home grow. And that way they can bust anybody who's got got marijuana plants outside of a state licensed grow site. That would be one way to handle it. You could send letters to landlords of dispensaries, landlords that are renting out land or warehouse space to grows, and tell them, hey, you are facilitating a federal crime, and we will file a seizure action. We'll seize your property and your bank accounts. That wouldn't take having to conduct any raids. Then just filing a letter, seize your assets, and then we just send the agents to go collect the stuff. That wouldn't be too hard to do. How about a letter to governors in the states that have legalized medical or recreational marijuana, telling them any of your state officials who issue licenses are abetting a federal crime, and they could face prosecution. See, they don't even necessarily have to follow through on some of these threats. There was a great line the other day on one of the TV shows I was watching. Maybe it was Bill Maher's show, where they said, the ability to punch you in the nose with a $1 million ad buy also gives you the ability to threaten to punch someone in the nose with a $1 million ad buy. They may not have to actually do it. Jeff Sessions framing the Cole memo as a checklist of here's who I get to bust. The threat of that could be all he needs to do to put a serious monkey wrench in the development of our marijuana industry. All right, stay tuned. We'll be right back to close up the show with my final thoughts.
This is the Russ Belville Show on CannabisRadio.com.
Get your tickets now for the Oregon Marijuana Business Conference, happening one day only in Eugene, Oregon on Friday, April 28th. You'll learn all about the latest OLCC regulations for adult use cannabis, including testing requirements, tech and branding, taxes and distribution, and the latest developments in medical marijuana regulations. OMBC features networking with Oregon's leading experts in marijuana, including State Senator Floyd Prezansky. You'll also get to hear from author, actor, and punk rock icon Henry Rollins delivering the keynote address. Early bird pricing is available for conference only and VIP passes, which gets you access to the VIP networking events featuring Henry Rollins and other speakers. It's the 2017 Oregon Marijuana Business Conference. Tickets available now at OregonMBC.com. That's OregonMBC.com before April 14th to get your early bird pricing. OregonMBC.com.
You're not high. You're listening to the Russ Belville Show.
Grandchildren now don't write a thank you for the Christmas presents. They're walking on their pants with their cap on backwards, listening to Enema Man and Snoopy Snoopy Poop Dog, and they don't like them.
Okay, maybe you're high, too.
This is Radical Russ Belville with a word about dealing with police. Whether marijuana is legal in your state, whether you're a medical marijuana patient, or whether you're a cannabis consumer just trying to survive under prohibition, you should always affirmatively assert your rights in a police encounter. This means you don't answer police questions without your attorney present, and you never consent to a search. Police are not your friend. Besides showing your insurance, registration, and driver's license, there are only three things you should be saying and one thing you should be doing. I cannot answer further questions without my attorney present. I do not consent to any searches. Am I under arrest or am I free to go? And then leave once you've been cleared to go. Don't stick around for any little talks the officer wants to have. Learn this lesson well, and unlike me, you won't have a criminal record. This has been a public service announcement from the Russ Belville Show.
You're tuned into the Russ Belville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation, only on CannabisRadio.com.
Welcome back, everyone. 53 after the hour as we close up shop here. Another quick tease to remind you that on May 1st, something big happens. May 1st. Put it on your agenda. Something big is happening in marijuana. In marijuana podcasting, I should say. So, I can't wait to tell you. I just can't tell you yet. So, as we go out, I wanted to talk real quick about a couple of studies that appeared in the Marijuana Moment newsletter. And by the way, if you haven't subscribed yet, go to marijuanamoment.net and subscribe to the absolutely free Marijuana Moment newsletter. Tom Angel puts it out every morning. He's on the East Coast, so it comes out early for me. And it's literally my prep sheet for this show now, folks. This one newsletter has cut like an hour off of my day just by providing links to all the latest stories that are happening. I mean, Tom's got his thumb on the pulse of this. He's really got it going on. So check it out at marijuanamoment.net. But on marijuanamoment.net, he's got all these different segments, federal, state, science, culture, international, all that kind of stuff. So there's a couple of links here in the science section I just wanted to mention. One of them says a literature review conducted that marijuana use is associated with increased risk of being victimized by and perpetrating dating violence. Really? Study claims that if you smoke pot, you're more likely to get violent with your partner, with your date, or be victimized in such a way. I don't know about this. This is another one of those things where Dr. Mitch talks about, marijuana is just a stand-in right now for some other confounder they're not accounting for, like the fact that marijuana users tend to be lower socioeconomic scale or younger people or whatever, and then that is why, those people tend to have more violence or whatever. We'll ask Dr. Mitch about it on a future episode next Monday. Another link here says a small study suggests that chronic and heavy cannabis abuse results in long-lasting brain dysfunction in all users and in long-lasting schizophrenia-like psychotic symptoms in more than half of all users. Like a Kevin Sabet wet dream quote there. Well, I don't know. I've been abusing cannabis chronically and heavily for about 27 years now. I guess this is the long-lasting brain dysfunction. I guess this is my long-lasting schizophrenia-like psychotic symptoms. Well, I'm crazy! Yeah. But on both of these studies, we'll talk to Dr. Mitch about it, but I do want to make a larger meta point about this. We can go day after day after day. This study says marijuana is good for you. It has this effect. That's great. This other study says marijuana is bad for you. It has this other effect that's terrible. And I just hope everyone understands that in the bigger scheme of things, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether marijuana harms me or not. It doesn't matter whether marijuana heals me or not. It doesn't matter. We're a society that has legalized the adult use of alcohol and tobacco. Two things that cure little to nothing. Two things that cause an extreme amount of harm. And we've said, hey, we're cool with that. It's a free society. Drink, fine. Poison your liver, whatever you want to do. Smoke, yeah, get lung cancer. We're cool with it. Hell, we know even that your lung cancer is going to cause a whole bunch of extra health care costs that we, the taxpayers, are on the hook for in some circumstances. But hey, go ahead, smoke some cigarettes, drink some booze. We know you're drinking the booze is going to cause some freeway wrecks and some deaths and some, spousal abuse and some things that, some fights in the streets and puking and stuff. We know it's going to cause that, but go ahead, drink. Oh, have fun. It's Miller time. There's no slowing down with a silver bullet tonight, man. You got to have some of that. So if that's the standard, if that's the society we're a part of, you've got nothing to tell me about this that makes any logical sense. You got no way to tell me this needs to be banned in a society that accepts alcohol and tobacco. So go ahead, tell me this perpetrates dating violence. Really? You want to see the alcohol stats on that? Tell me this causes long-lasting problems with cognition. You want to see the alcohol stats on that? Well, folks, that's all the time we got for today. Thanks for joining us. For everyone here at Delta 9 Studios, I'm Radical Russ. Appreciate you being here. Thanks to all the VIPs who help keep this project moving. You can donate if you'd like to be a part of it. And you get your VIP in now, and you get a special entry into the really cool thing that's happening May 1st. You can join up just by sending me some money. PayPal.me/RadicalRuss. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Until next time, take care of each other, tokers.
This is the Russ Belville Show. The Russ Belville Show is blogging and podcasting daily at RadicalRuss.com. You take a seat, you're planning to.
you're growing, you're giant, you're rolling, you're smoking. You take a seat, you manage, you're growing, you're giant, you're rolling, you're smoking. You take a seat, you manage, you're growing, you're giant, you're rolling, you're smoking, and it goes down smooth.
You're listening to the Russ Belville Show.
Marijuana is not heroin.
You can find Radical Russ online everywhere.